90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. 1 o'clock here in WILL AM 580 time to jump with Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I'll be together with you for a full hour live today. We're going to be talking about the shape of news, how it's evolved over the past generation, where it is today, where it might be going. We'll be talking to two authors of a brand new book that takes a long-term view and looks pointedly at the great changes going on in the news today in the practice of journalism. It should be a wonderful show. I hope you'll join us for the full hour. But before we get to our guests, let's get to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
In his State of the Union address last month, President Barack Obama said that updating critical infrastructure, including high-speed broadband networks, should be a national priority. Yet our national broadband plan makes no mention of one of the most successful nonprofit models for getting those critical networks to rural areas.
The way the national broadband plan is written, you wouldn't even know that rural co-ops ever existed or the nonprofit business model was even relevant to this issue.
Wally Bowen runs the Mountain Area Information Network, a nonprofit internet service provider in western North Carolina that works with many local partners. He wants the FCC and Congress to ensure that nonprofit rural cooperatives are eligible for funding from the $15.5 billion Connect America Fund that the National Broadband Plan is calling for.
I just don't think the members of Congress who represent rural areas, I don't think they have a clue that how this thing's been written so that the money only goes to incumbents.
The National Broadband Plan mentions municipal broadband networks as one of two options for rural broadband, the other being private for-profit carriers. But municipal networks are banned or curtailed in more than 20 states thanks to industry-backed legislation. Rural co-ops, on the other hand, are privately owned. Bowen says it's a scandal that there is no mention of the hundreds of rural electrical and telecom co-ops that now offer broadband services.
To reduce the options for policymakers for rural broadband to municipal ownership or for-profit carriers is a false choice, and it clearly sounded like it had been written by a telecom lobbyist.
The United States has a long history of community-owned nonprofits. Rural electrification co-ops wired the countryside during the 1930s and 40s. The 1936 Rural Electrification Act was later amended to ensure universal access to telephone services. And there's another example of a community-owned nonprofit, the Green Bay Packers. A community of only 104,000 people has the winningest franchise in NFL history, competing with much larger cities and billionaire owners. Team profits go right back into the community.
They have done remarkably well because their business model is in scale, is in sync with the market they serve, and profits stay local. No one would ever look at the Green Bay Packers and call it a government-owned football team. It's not. It's owned by the community. It's a nonprofit. And it's the same thing with most of the community networks in rural areas. And yet, it's not even referenced in the National Broadband Plan.
Every year, millions of viewers tune in to the Super Bowl, not just for the game, but also for the expensive, over-the-top, and brand-stamping commercials. The Super Bowl ads are as much a part of game day tradition as the national anthem. But one group is challenging many of these ads for being sexist, hyper-masculine, and degrading to women. Misrepresentation.org, a campaign stemming from the documentary of the same name, asked Super Bowl viewers to call out offensive or sexist ads over Twitter using the hashtag NotBuyingIt. Amy Zuccaro, the campaign director for misrepresentation.org, said thousands of people responded and flooded Twitter to express their outrage and disgust.
We had fathers and daughters and grandparents and mothers, and we had very high-profile bloggers along with just your average person who uses Twitter to communicate with their friends and family.
Zuccaro said this year's biggest offenders were a Fiat ad that turned a woman's body into a car, a Teleflora ad that suggested women would trade sex for flowers, and an ad from the website domain hosting business GoDaddy.
There's always GoDaddy, which every year just gets raunchier and raunchier with their advertising. This year, they used a woman's body as a billboard.
Zuccaro said these representations of women in the media can be damaging for both women and men and can affect how we view gender roles in our society.
People are getting so much information from the media, and they're getting false information about who women are, what they are, how they should be treated, and what should be expected of women or shouldn't be expected of women. I think when you see all of that in media, it's just a complete disconnect from what the world looks like, but then it also influences the world.
The misrepresentation campaign is urging people to write to the worst offenders and ask them to stop making degrading ads. Misrepresentation has also requested a meeting with NBC, the network the Super Bowl airs on, and is asking people to protest GoDaddy by switching to another domain provider.
People are starting to really feel empowered to actually go out and use their consumer power to create change.
Zuccaro is also encouraging people to take a pledge on their website to challenge the limited portrayal of women and girls throughout the media, not just in the Super Bowl ads. To find out more, visit misrepresentation.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Our guests today are the authors of a brand new book, After Broadcast News, Media Regimes, Democracy, and the New Information Environment, just published by Cambridge University Press. The guests are Bruce A. Williams, a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, and Michael Della Carpini, who serves as the dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Bruce, Michael, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
All right. Do we have you, Bruce? Well, I hear Michael. Bruce is taking a break, I guess.
He was here a minute ago.
I'm sure he'll come back. Well, Michael, I'm glad we've got you on the horn. So let's get started if we can.
Sure.
First of all, you know, what's the idea behind the book? Why did you decide to write this book? What were you trying to capture?
Well, the central theme of the book starts with an obvious premise that the information environment has changed radically in the last 10 to 15 years for a variety of reasons, including new technology, but that's only one of the reasons. And the reason we wrote the book is that we felt that the way that that was being discussed was missing the fact that the media environment in the United States actually changes a lot. And we've gone through a number of different periods where how we got information of public import has been really, really different. And most of the discussion of the new information environment started from the premise that what existed in the latter half of the 20th century was the only thing we ever had and was the best thing we ever had. And we start with the argument that says, wait a minute, there were some good things about the latter part of the 20th century, but there were some bad things. And if you look more historically, it puts the new information environment in a very, very different light.
Yeah, and you call the media regime, the recent era that we've come out of, that we're in the process of leaving now, broadcast news. Can you, Michael Della Carpini, sort of sum up what the contours of that regime are? I suspect they'll be rapidly identified or understood by most of our listeners, but just sort of get at what the heart and soul of that system was.
Yeah, so really the period of the latter half of the 20th century, which we do call the age of broadcast news, had a couple of characteristics. Number one, the idea that journalists, professional journalists, were the arbiters of what was important and what was not. Number two, that they made those decisions provided it to the public through a very, very limited number of centralized and centrally owned broadcast news organizations. And number three, that they operated under some rules that they weren't always able to follow, but the rules being that you could separate fact from opinion, you could separate the truth from the non-truth, you could separate entertainment from news, that there was a small window in which we got publicly useful information and the rest of the media was largely for entertainment. As we argue in the book, there were some reasons why that model worked okay, but there were lots of reasons why it did not work so well.
Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, is Michael Dolly-Carpini. He's the co-author with Bruce Williams of the new book, After Broadcast News, Media Regimes, Democracy, and the New Information Environment. Bruce Williams is about to join us on the phone. And while we're getting Bruce Williams hooked up with us, let me say that we are approaching now the 10th anniversary of Media Matters being on the air here on WILL. The 10th anniversary will come just about 5 or 6 weeks from now. We're going to be having a special Bonanza show, which will overlap with the Pledge Drive show. Of course, on the program with me that day will be our longtime co-conspirator John Nichols joining us, and we'll be talking about all things political in this election year. We'll be talking about campaigns and the like. I think you'll get a kick out of the show. We've got some special stuff planned for it. And I know that those of you listening to the show have been listening for a long time, are familiar with common themes that we have. We're going to have several books available at the Pledge Drive show to celebrate the 10th anniversary, more than usual. And it's really going to be, we hope, a cornucopia of media criticism and media literature that you'll be delighted with. We're waiting now, and I'm in here to see when we get our guest back on the line. It's going to be shortly. We're going to get Bruce back, Bruce Williams, to join us. Let me tell you about upcoming guests on the program. One of the guests we're looking forward to having very much is a colleague of Michael Dolly-Carpini's, our guest today, Joseph Turow, who has a new book out called The Daily U on advertising and the Internet, which I've just had the privilege of reading. And this is a book I think, listeners, you are going to find one of the most important books of the last year or 2 years, because he talks in the book about how advertising has come to play such a central role behind the scenes in the nature of the Internet, how the programming works, the privacy factor, and the relationship between the government and the private sector. It's really one of the most exceptional books we've seen in some time, and I think you're going to really enjoy it when we get to it. Related to that, we're also going to have the privilege of having a special show with Susan Herman from the ACLU on the state of civil liberties in the United States today, and we'll be giving you more detail on that. But before we go on any further, let's go back to our guest, Michael Dolly-Carpini, who's been on the line with us, the Dean of Communication at the Annenberg School, University of Pennsylvania, and Bruce Williams, his co-author of After Broadcast News, Professor of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. Bruce Williams, have you joined us now?
Yes, I think I have. Can you
hear me? You'll be very glad to know, Bruce, that your co-author has done an admirable job of explaining the nature of the book, what the book's about, and what the point of writing the book was. And I wanted to ask you before now, you know, Michael mentioned how important technology is as a factor. And another factor that you mentioned in the book is commercialism. How much has commercial pressures been central to unraveling the media regime of broadcast news of the last 40 or 50 years?
I think it's been very important. And one of the things that we try and do in the book is really try and show that a lot of the difference that we try and point out between kind of the ideals of professional journalism, if you will, what professional journalism was supposed to do in providing citizens useful information. That a lot of those, while we focus so much on the technological changes that have challenged the authority of professional journalism, I think that the fact, as your work, you know, really is a pioneer in this, pointing this out, that it is a lot of the idea that it is advertising revenues that are going to pay for journalism. And that was breaking down long before we had or interfering with a lot of the ideals of journalism, way before, you know, the Internet was a factor and the other technological innovations that we grapple with today.
Michael Dolly-Carpini, in this regime of professional journalism that all the three of us grew up with, and most of our listeners, I assume, did, and it still exists to no small extent, but it's changing. What was the good part of it, and what was the downside of it?
Right. So, some of the good things that came out of that model are, I think, pretty self-evident. Number one, you have a class of people, professional journalists, who are both trained and paid
to have as their central responsibility informing as best they can the public about major issues of the day. And that's a pretty heady task. And so having a group of people whose job it is to do that is a really, really valuable thing for some obvious reasons. Number two, in the era of broadcast news, one of the benefits was that when we all sat down, as most of us did in the, at least in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, to watch the news, we were part of a national conversation. What we saw on the news tended to be the same on the three major networks in the early days, four or five networks later in this regime. What we all saw was largely the same, and one of the benefits of that is that we could all be thinking about, learning about, and talking about the same set of hopefully important issues. The downside, and the other thing I'd say that's positive, is that even when journalists failed, there was a relatively clear set of standards that we could measure them against so that we could say you did a good job or you didn't do a good job. But there were some norms and some rules involved in this. The downside, of course, is the flip side of that. If there's a handful of people that are telling us what's important, what they ignore, nobody knows about. If they get it wrong, then we all get it wrong. And if they can't follow the norms very effectively, it's not always easy to know when they failed and when they haven't. And so it has all the benefits and all the negative aspects of having a small, elite, centralized group of people telling us what we should know, and the rest of us largely being consumers rather than active participants in this process.
Can you give an example, Michael Delacarpini, of a type of story where that would manifest itself that would really be sort of damaging for a democratic society?
Well, I mean, the most obvious recent one in a period that was more transitional would be the buildup to the war in Iraq. I mean, the Washington Post, the main newspapers of the era, which drove in many ways what broadcast news covered, the New York Times and the Washington Post, have both published long statements about how they failed in that period and how they were manipulated both by the government and the military, but also by some of the rules that governed the way in which they could cover these kind of issues. And as a result of that, I think it's fair to say that the public was badly misinformed in the build-up to that war, and arguably, had they been better informed, we may have not gotten involved in what I think in retrospect was a really problematic military engagement by the United States. But those kind of examples of not knowing till after the fact what was really going on, I think is an example of where when you have a limited number of people providing information, when they get it wrong, we all get it wrong.
Can I jump in?
Please do, Bruce Williams.
There's a different kind of failure, if you will, of this old regime. And as Michael said, one of the real problems we have is what happens when the rules of professional journalism or the way they are exercised at a particular time lead to stories and issues not being covered. And that's really difficult. But one of the things that we look at in the book, for example, is the coverage over a fairly long period of time of global climate change in the mainstream press, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the three major network news broadcasts. And what you find when you look at that is that this was an issue that was covered over a very long period of time, very minimally and very poorly. And what you wind up with is a public that is easily manipulated by the way interest groups can manipulate the coverage of the media. Another related issue that is very current now is the question of economic inequality. Economic inequality didn't become a huge issue is not something you needed to discover yesterday. This is something that has been growing for over 30 years, and yet when we looked at the amount of coverage, for example, on the network news over a 30-year period
of economic inequality, while that inequality was growing very rapidly, there was virtually no coverage of the issue. And so when you have incrementally changing, slowly changing circumstances like global climate change or economic inequality, the regime of professional journalism did an extremely poor job of covering that.
Now, Bruce Williams, has this new transitional phase where there's many more voices and the authority of professional journalists is much less, has it improved the quality? Has it opened up the debate and dialogue on economics, on the environment? I take it from what Michael Della Carpini just said, it hasn't really knocked the ball over the fence with regard to U.S. invasions of other countries. The coverage hasn't gotten necessarily any better there. Has it done a better job of sort of broadening out with these other issues?
Well, I think it yes and no. I mean, I think that all of the changes that we're seeing, one of the incredible dramatic expansion in the number of gates through which political information now flows, from blogging to YouTube to Twitter to the normal sources that we, you know, the mainstream sources that we rely on now online as well as in print or on TV. I think that on the one hand, there is much more information of a very high quality from diverse sources that is easily available to anyone with, and here's the key, with the skills and motivations and opportunities, as Michael, you know, would argue in terms of what shapes whether how people get political information. There's much more of it out there. The problem is it's also much easier to ignore all of that. And I think there are vibrant conversations that go on about these issues, but they are they don't bring in that broad public daily conversation that Michael was alluding to, that was really one of the hallmarks of the period where everyone tuned into the nightly network news every night.
Our guest, Bruce Williams, you've just been listening to, and Michael Della Carpini, they're the co-authors of the brand new book, After Broadcast News, Media Regimes, Democracy, and the New Information Environment, just published by Cambridge University Press. The phone lines are open here at Media Matters. Our number 217-333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Discerning listeners may well recall that Bruce Williams, once on the faculty here at the University of Illinois, for what, 12 years or so, Bruce?
12 years, yes.
12 years here on the faculty, so you might have some old friends listening. Let's hope so. I think that so far it's been sort of abstract, our discussion, and I'd like to sort of get it down more to brass tacks. And perhaps, Michael, the first chapter is, can you tell the difference between Tina Fey and Katie Kirk? That's the title. What is this whole entertainment mixture of journalism that's going on, and is there something positive to it? Is there some example of the sort of story where this has actually enhanced the effectiveness and democratic role of journalism, or is this purely garbage?
No, it's definitely not purely garbage, and it's and I think our bottom line is that properly done, it's an enhancement rather than a detraction from the information environment that we live in. But for a specific example that draws on the title of that chapter, so think about the 2008 presidential election, and think about the moment when Sarah Palin was nominated as the vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party. If you go back and look at the way in which the mainstream media addressed that issue, they addressed it the way they tend to address these kind of issues initially all the time, which is they start from a premise that it's their job to be objective and fair. They interpret what that means as being giving, quote, both sides of the issue. And they wound up as a result of that, because the Democrats were taken a little bit by surprise, and both sides of the issue in the American media system of the latter 20th century almost always meant what the Republicans and the Democrats were saying, that the Democrats taken aback a little bit, Republicans had a clearer narrative, and as a result of that, the coverage was relatively balanced, but also relatively neutral and relatively positive early on for Sarah Palin. It wasn't until some of the entertainment media, The Daily Show and especially Saturday Night Live, began to create an alternative image, if you will, of Sarah Palin, that some of the questions about her readiness to be vice president really emerged. And it was it is not too much of an exaggeration to say that the entertainment news in the United States, the Saturday Night Lives and the Daily Shows, drove the mainstream news coverage that followed into a more questioning kind of assessment of Sarah Palin's politics, experience, readiness to be vice president. Now, depending on your politics, you could say that's a good or a bad thing, but the argument here is that we now live, this is a great example of where we now live in an environment where different parts of the media environment, not just the news division, can play a really central role in shaping what the news agenda and what people are thinking about.
Bruce Williams, one of the issues you talk about in the book, and it's really become an enormous part of the American media environment over the past two decades, growing out of the regime of broadcast news, the dominant professional regime, has been the enormous growth of sort of a stridently partisan media sector, which is, I think, fair to say, overwhelmingly far right wing to the political right, Fox News being the most famous example, but talk radio being second. And where does that fit into your argument? What role is that playing? How does this part of the changing news environment?
I'm going to answer that, I think, in two ways. I mean, first, I think what's important here is, I share your concern with that kind of the incredible partisanship that I think results from the fact that now someone who is very interested in politics can spend 24 hours, 7 days a week just getting all their information from Fox News. But I think first it's important to say that that professional journalists, I think, are no less able to get a hold of that and criticize it, because what you see again and again is, you know, there's this need for journalists to say, well, there's political extremism and it's on both sides. And I think that's kind of the typical journalistic approach to this. I think that on the one hand, if you look at the demographics and of something like The Daily Show as opposed to, let's say, The O'Reilly Factor, they're really interesting because they both have, The O'Reilly Factor gets a slightly bigger audience, but The Daily Show is watched by more, about 13%, according to the latest figures, of people between 18 and 29. The average age of The O'Reilly Factor is at least 65. So there's a sense in which I think I'm not sure how all of this is going to shake out over the next several years, because I think that the Daily Show and other places, if you want to point to MSNBC, which again has a smaller audience than Fox, I think it's unclear to me whether the dominance of right-wing ideology is going to last forever, or whether that's just a result of generational dynamics as this system develops. I think the real question, the real problem is the lack of communication across these audiences, because these two are very different audiences with very little overlap. And the lack of the authority at the center of professional journalists to at least give us some agreed-upon facts of the matter. I think, for me, that is one of the real concerns here. It's not that people have these kind of ideological places they can go to talk about and hear about things. It's the lack of agreed-upon facts of the matter, or that would at least allow both sides to engage each other.
Our guest, Bruce Williams, you've just been listening to, and Michael Della Carpini, co-authors of the new book, After Broadcast News, just published by Cambridge University Press. The phone lines are open here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455, or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Let's start with line one, Lafayette, Indiana. Welcome to Media Matters.
I guess my comment, although I agree that a lack of agreed facts is a problem, always has been a problem, probably always will be a problem, the range of available broadcast news has been much larger than your guests are indicating. Like from 1962, I could listen to Radio Moscow, I could listen to the BBC or Radio Havana, Cuba, Deutsche Welle, Radio Peking, and lots of more. So I could get as many news as I wanted as long as I had time to do it. That's basically my comment.
Okay, well, thank you very much, caller. I guess if I understand the caller's point, Michael De Carpini, that if one had a shortwave radio, for example, one would have access to a world of alternative visions long before the era of the Internet and cable television.
Yeah, and one of the things we struggle with, or at least try to balance in this, is that many of the trends we're talking about, it's not as if it was a light switch in which it was only one environment originally and now a very different one. But if you step back even just for a minute, first of all, you had to have a shortwave radio for the kinds of shows that your caller just mentioned, and that's a much limited, more limited audience than anything that we have right now. Number two, even in those cases, oftentimes the shows that you were able to pick up were shortwave shows that were broadcast in many cases, like Voice of America, by more centralized entities. And so certainly you did not get to hear the voice of the publics in these various communities and so on. And the last point I guess I'd make about this is that the sheer number of opportunities and the ease with which you can get to them now, I think, is much more dramatic. We have a tendency, this is partly the kind of market culture that we live in, to think that as long as it's out there and you can get to it in some way, that the media environment's doing its job. And one of the points that we want to make is that it's not meant to be a test of endurance in order to be informed as a citizen. And there are many opportunities now where we could get information more easily that should be taken advantage of.
Bruce Williams, we've had a discussion so far where the case studies haven't quite done justice, I think, to the strength of your argument, because by emphasizing environmental issues or issues where there are strong interests, corporate interest, or, for example, invasions of Iran or Iraq or whatever the country might be, the similarity to earlier type journalism is what jumps out more than the difference in how it was covered 10, 20, 30 years ago. What's the sort of issue, a good example of the sort of story you could give of how, the new media environment we're entering is really quite different, and new voices are entering that were formerly excluded and actually having an influence on the way stories are covered and understood?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are, first of all, I think that one of the real big differences is in some international stories. If you think about the way if you want to call them revolutions, the demonstrations in Iran or Egypt, they are covered today very differently than they would have been 30 years ago. I mean, now it's possible for us to get direct reports, if you will, from people on the ground. Think of the power of the video of that young woman being shot and killed in a demonstration in Iran. And I find what's and I think that is a story that really it was a big important story that lots of Americans paid attention to. And what's interesting to me about that story is that's occurring at a time where, because of economic pressures, the mainstream news organizations, especially the broadcast and cable news stations, are cutting back dramatically in the number of foreign bureaus they have, the number of foreign reporters that are available to cover stories like that. I also think that when it comes to whether an issue sticks on the agenda, whether it stays in the public's eyes,
I think that there are many more possibilities now. For example, if you think about what happens when Jon Stewart runs a story, as he did last week, on the watering down of legislation in Congress to outlaw insider trading by Congress. That's an issue that was covered several months ago on 60 Minutes, but it's the kind of issue that it had its moment in the sun. And I think it's possible now for other voices to help set the agenda in a way that was not possible 25 years ago.
And if I could just jump in for a second, Bob, I think here in the U.S., a couple of examples that I think you could make a strong case would have played out very differently were it not for the new media environment. The strongest one in my mind domestically is the Occupy Wall Street movement, which, you know, it's hard to know what its long-term effects will be. I think it's a mistake to dismiss them because they're a little bit out of the public eye right now, because I think that movement has legs. But certainly the way in which it played out, the way in which it got coverage, the way in which it found itself into the mainstream media, the way in which even when the mainstream media ignored them, they were able to continue through horizontal communications to keep people informed who were interested, the way in which they were able to use the new media to be able to fight back, in quotes, when there were more repressive moments in the movement, the way they were able to organize domestically and eventually internationally. I think that's all a reflection of how the media environment, communications environment has changed. I think you could say the same thing about, in a slightly different way, taking advantage of the partisan press, the way the Tea Party was able to have its impact in the United States. So I want to make clear that the particular politics of this can vary. Who gets to control this environment can vary quite a bit. And I think you could even make the case that the recent outrage over the Komen Race for the Cure issue, and their having to back off on their initially backing off of supporting Planned Parenthood, was a result of this new media environment. So there are lots of examples. Even the regardless of where you stand on the outcome, even the having to back off on the SOPA regulations, where you see two sectors of the communications world, the old mainstream media on the one hand, and the new Googles and new technology media on the other hand, taking advantage of this environment to battle it out using the new media. These are all examples, I think, of how politics plays out in a very different way now.
Our guests, Michael Della Carpini, you just heard speaking, and Bruce Williams, co-authors of After Broadcast News, Media Regimes, Democracy, and the New Information Environment, just published by Cambridge University Press. The phone number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Bruce Williams, one of the themes that permeates the book, and it's come up throughout the program today already, has been this whole notion of partisanship versus nonpartisanship, which was the hallmark of the old media regime, the broadcast news regime. And what's your sense of that whole question? Is that a fundamental question that we have to answer for understanding journalism and news? Is it good? Is it bad? How should listeners who are constantly asking me about this and concerned about it to deal with the fact that we seem to be in a much more partisan journalism today? And is that not a bad thing, a good thing, or how should they regard it?
Well, I think that one of the advantages that we try and argue comes from looking historically at what we would call the different media regimes that the United States has been through over the last 225 years, is that you see that a lot of phrases that we think have, kind of a natural and everyone knows what they mean, really don't. And partisanship is one of those words. It turns out that one of the ways that journalists have defined being nonpartisan is by simply, as Michael said before, by saying there are two sides to every story, and those sides are determined by the Democratic and Republican Party. Now, there are other definitions of partisanship that are important. If you go back to the mid-19th century, another definition of partisanship was the one that was adopted by the abolitionist press, which said that, you know, neither the Democratic Party or the Whig Party at the time wanted to talk about slavery. So if that was your, if you had the journalistic idea of nonpartisanship, that meant slavery could not be covered in the press. Now, the abolitionist press said, well, you know, another notion, another idea of nonpartisanship is issues that are outside what the two parties want to say, and it's important to bring those issues up. And so I think that it's important that we understand that the way journalists go about being nonpartisan is not the only way that one can be nonpartisan, and a frustration that a lot of us have, I think, is that it seems to me that another version of nonpartisanship is to say when the Democrats say X and the Republicans say Y, that reporters can point out that, well, you know, X is not true. It's just simply not true. And I think it's that idea of how we introduce different ideas of partisanship. I mean, partisanship is at the heart of American politics, but there are very different ways of understanding it and enacting it through the media.
Let me ask, and Michael, you can feel this if you'd like. I mean, so someone who watches Fox News today, which I think is probably considered the most explicitly partisan television network that people have seen in the United States in ever, and it plays a very large role and gets a significant percentage of its viewers are self-identified conservatives. Is this the sort of partisan journalism we had in the first 100 years of American history? Is this sort of what Jefferson, there was the Fox News of his day. Is this pretty much going back to our roots?
In some ways, yes. We definitely had an era of print journalism in the early parts of our history in which the newspapers at the time were sometimes more explicitly than Fox News likes to be connected to one of the other parties, and in which their goal was to forward the mission or the agenda of that party, the facts be damned. And so certainly you can point to examples of early press coverage that was partisan in a way that would be very similar to what we see with Fox News. But what's different as well, and this is why it's important to look at various periods, is there also was an era just after that really highly partisan in the current meaning of the word press, where there was a movement towards what was called independent partisan press. And by the independent partisan press, what those newspapers meant was they had a point of view. They had a kind of philosophy as to how the politics should work, but they felt committed to speaking out even against their own party when they felt that that party was going off the rails or missing the point and missing the argument. And
so when was that era, Michael?
It was the latter part of the era of the partisan press, so it would be going into the mid to late 19th century that you see some of this,
mm-hmm.
and the mission statements of those newspapers actually describe themselves as with the term independent partisanship. But the larger point I think that we're trying to make about the new environment is not so much that that it should or could reflect past periods, but at each moment when the media system changes, there's usually a point where it changes so much, as we're in today, that people step back and say, wait a minute, we thought we knew how this worked, and it's not working the way we thought it did, so what should we do? And it's that moment when people say to each other, what should we do, that provides a real opportunity to try to get it right this time, to say, well, what is it about the age of broadcast news that we really think was valuable? I think it'd be hard to picture a media environment that was effective in the 21st century if it did not include some notion of professional journalists, including the notion of professional journalists whose job it was, whose purpose it was, to try to be as balanced and fair as possible. We want that in this new environment, but we don't want that to be the only thing we have. And when it comes to the partisan press, we would like to see a partisan press in which you have a point of view,
because one of the criticisms of the age of broadcast news is that by being, quote, neutral, it gave you decontextualized facts to the point that people were not interested in it. You didn't even know what to make of it. But there, it's not the same thing to say, excuse me, I'm partisan, and so therefore the facts don't matter, and being partisan and saying, but I've got an obligation to make my argument based on some kind of reason and tethering it in some way to what is actually going on. And that's what's missing in Fox News today, is the unwillingness. The ideology trumps the facts in this on Fox News is the way that I would put it. And any media outlet, whether it's trying to be neutral or trying to be partisan, the norms that we operate under should punish media outlets that feel no obligation to tether themselves to some notion of what is actually going on in the world.
Before we go back to our phone lines, and we do have callers waiting patiently, I just want to follow up on this with you, Bruce Williams, because I know you and I have talked about this over the years, and it's an issue you've thought a lot about. You know, it strikes me this whole question of partisanship as being a boogeyman. I think Michael gave a really great answer just there. But, you know, you look at academic scholarship like your book, or anything I write, or anything anyone writes, really, in social science and the humanities, it would be considered partisan in the fact that it has viewpoints, but it doesn't mean it doesn't have to produce evidence and be able to defend it from attack from people who might not share your values.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that and some of our discomfort with that idea, I think, stems precisely from the dominant rules of, you know, professional journalism that reached their peak of authority in the age of broadcast news. I mean, it's always been interesting to me to look at the different words that journalists have used to describe what it is they're doing that gives them this kind of authority. And they've moved from things like objectivity to being disinterested, to being nonpartisan. And I think that what that winds up masking is that, you know, inevitably what's really important to know about the information that we are receiving is the rules that were used to put it together. And I think that, I think that almost every person writes from a standpoint, from a particular perspective. But that doesn't mean that you can dismiss someone's writing if you just disagree with the ideological perspective they came into it with. I think that one of the things that's really needed, and this comes from conversations that I've had with you, Bob, and with your friend John Nichols, is that the idea of expressing an opinion in the media ought not be so different from the way a student writes a paper in college or the way you or I write any book or paper that we write, where we have a thesis. I mean, we have an argument about the way the world works. And that, because we're committed to that argument, doesn't mean we can ignore the facts or we can ignore the results of people that have looked at the world in a different way. And it's that respect for the logic of an argument that has political implications, I think, that really needs to be foregrounded and dealt with much more explicitly in public discourse. And I think that it's as important a task to really understand what's involved in making claims about the political world to the public that needs to be applied to a much broader range of actors today than was the case 35 years ago.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line one, Champaign County, you're on the air with Michael Delacarpini and Bruce Williams, authors of After Broadcast News.
Hi. Usual overstimulating conversation. I'm happy with it. But, I wanted to reprise one of the common themes of your work, Bob, which is that our founding fellows had something to do with the pamphlets that were so diverse and partisan, et cetera. They found a neutral way to subsidize journalism, which was to subsidize newsprint and postal rates. And I think that analogy should be brought into the electronic age. And I guess there's probably tracks up about that on freespeech.net. But I'm still hooked up with a remark that was sort of not given enough attention a few minutes ago, which was the question about sort of reporting on world issues, war and peace around the world, and it was said by one of the speakers that material is available from so many different sources. But just looking at how many correspondents are abroad, we don't have that many people. We have less than we ever have, and if you even set that aside and just look at the sort of the Chomsky argument about limits of allowable debate, and what editors expect and how you can frame issues and maybe some even unconscious framing of issues about America's role in the world, et cetera, we have really an awful reporting on war and peace and world issues, it seems to me, and I think that maybe it's beyond the scope of this book and this discussion, but I think it's one of the most critical things to grapple with. Just one anecdote, and then I'll sign off and wait for reactions, which is that I'm finding that a portal site that I use, commondreams.org, has been breaking, as far as I'm concerned, more stories about the Iranian situation than the regular media is. They have a post up right now, which they didn't get directly, but they framed it, and that's that Pakistan has announced that they'll be on Iran's side if there's an attack on Iran, which is a little bit odd because they're not normal allies. But so I'm just saying that using that as an example of a new media doing different things, but also just highlighting the fact they don't have reporters there. They're just watching the world press in a different way. So thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, caller. There's a lot there. And let me, if I can, sort of sharpen that question and throw it first to you, Michael, and see what you think of it. Because this issue of Iran, I read Glenn Greenwald as a frequent guest in our program. His column in Salon.com frequently, he's one of the award-winning journalists. And I don't think he's ever been as apoplectic as he's been for the last month over the mainstream news media coverage of what's going on in Iran today. And what he views as extraordinarily lack of evidence for incredible claims to justify war against Iran in excess of what was used in 2003, in the journalism being no better than it had been in 2003, maybe worse. And I think this might be what the caller was getting at, that, where's the beef of all this new stuff happening that's undercutting the dominance of authority? How would you deal with that?
Let me take a shot at it, Bruce, and then you can jump in. But I think the caller actually, in a way, answered the question in the call. So the point that he was making, number one, that the mainstream media, when it comes to international news coverage, is doing as poor, maybe even a worse job than it's done in the past, in part because of the cuts in foreign bureaus and because of the market-driven notion that if it's not about something that's happening here domestically, it's not worth covering, and people don't want to hear that kind of news. I mean, I think he's right about that, and that's part of the point that we're making, is that the mainstream media is having problems right now, and a good deal of those problems are because we've moved to a market environment, a kind of neoliberalism that doesn't even treat journalism as if it is a public good, but is simply another television show that we watch. But both he and you, in your sharpening of the question, Bob, talked about these other sources that you can turn to that allow you to get some information that says, wait a minute, there's a problem here. The information is wrong. The information is not enough. You can go as far as WikiLeaks to talk about how that information that we never would have had before. That's exactly the change that we're capturing. And part of what's got to happen is a mindset change that does not see the mainstream broadcast and print news media in the United States as the place where we get information. I mean, I'd love to see that improved. We make suggestions in the book about how there needs to be public support for those institutions and for mainstream journalism, but we have to stop thinking about the news or the information environment as being just those places. It's a much wider set of sources that are available to us now. But Bruce, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, and just, I mean, I think to sharpen what Michael is saying, I think that part of what we're arguing is not that, the past regime was worthless or that, we need something entirely new. it is to say that all of these media regimes had strengths and weaknesses. And I think that one of the and it's important to look historically, because I think one of the worst mistakes we can make as we move forward is to idealize a kind of golden age when the New York Times and the Washington Post and the nightly network news broadcasts somehow did it all right, that really reached, achieved their goals. And I think that when it comes to the reporting of issues of war and peace, I think historically, journalists, if you look back, have not done a very good job of that. And this is true if you go back to coverage in the New York Times of Nazi Germany in the 1930s. I mean, a lot of the reporting was horrible because it was filtered through a lot of assumptions about, you know, how stable the Nazis had made Germany, or, you know, all sorts of beliefs. But when you read that coverage, it doesn't strike one as, you know, the kind of information that is that much different than what we saw in the run-up to the war in Iraq. I think that what's different now is, and it's imperfect, and it reaches very small audiences, but I think it is undeniable that now it is easier than it's ever been to really find sources of information, even if it is individuals on the ground or the foreign press. It is easier to access that now than it's ever been. And the real question then is, who takes advantage of it, how individual citizens understand and evaluate and critique the information that comes to them. And I think that, you know, that that's the real challenge now.
You know, and I just got an email from a friend who's listening, a direct email, in fact, on this exact point, and wanting me to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Michael. You know, you're an American person who lives in this country, who has an internet connection, and who works a full-time job and has a family and obligations, and only has so much time to sit at the computer or to consume news media in any form. You know, what should your diet be? What is your diet? And he just wanted to know, this emailer, you know, what do you do? What do you consider, what are you looking at to get your hands, you know, get the lay of the land of the world in your side, your busy schedule? What do you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, I want to make clear that anything that can be done to make the consumption of useful information easier is a plus. And so we don't want to make this sound like it's all just on the shoulders of individuals. But I'll tell you what I do.
Yeah.
I rarely watch the mainstream broadcast news, and when I do, I watch it mainly to critique it. I read on my iPad nowadays the top news stories and dig in deeper when necessary, the New York Times and the local Philadelphia Inquirer, where I live here in Philly, for a variety of purposes. But then, when I have time, if a story interests me that I'm reading in the mainstream press, I will always go to another source just to see what the other take is. So I have an app for Al Jazeera on my iPhone.
You know, I hear the band tuning up in the background. Bruce Williams, you can add in a couple of goodies if you'd like.
Yes, we suggest, we have this phrase, grazing. And we think that given the media environment today, that whatever amount of time you have to spend informing yourself about the world, even if it's only the 30 minutes that you used to devote to the broadcast news, we think that grazing, that is exploring several different sources, taking advantage of this diversity, rather than focusing entirely on any one source.
Unfortunately, Bruce Williams, the band's tuning, getting louder, okay. And that means they want me out of the studio. I want to thank you, Bruce Williams and Michael Della Carpini, for joining us today to discuss your book, After Broadcast News. I wish you the best of luck with it.
Thank you. Good talking.
Thank you, Bob.
And I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board, and special thanks to Melissa Trentz, who came back for an encore performance as the show's producer today. Thank you so much, Melissa. I hope all goes well for you. And listeners, thank you, too. We'll be back 167 hours. We're going to be discussing what sort of economy could we have after capitalism with one of the great economists who studied it. I'm Bob McChesney. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Clearing skies today with highs around 40 degrees. Tonight, clear, lows in the lower 20s. Tomorrow, on Washington's birthday, sunny, high in the upper 40s. Southeast scent. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana.
From